Hello, friends. This is the first of our three new talks. These talks are entitled Destiny in the Stars. They are three talks on astrology by John Lash and what it's not. So I will first describe the talks and then we will proceed with the first one. So the first talk, in the first talk, John describes his struggles and conflicts working as a consulting astrologer for 30 years, explaining what led him to formulate an alternative zodiac based on observation of actual star patterns. He points out why the word astrology is misleading, although astrology itself is valid in its own terms. In the second talk, Sign Zodiac and Star Zodiac, John details in simple language the difference between the two zodiacs and proposes what he calls the genotype to contrast with the horoscope. Discussing tropical, sidereal, Vedic versions of astrology, he explains the implications of the true star zodiac, the circle of 13 constellations, for our notion of destiny. In the third talk, he introduces the idea that genius can be inherited, but not from blood relations. John defines the endowment or genomic inheritance we each carry and demonstrates how to read Starbase, his unique format of constellational astrology. In conclusion, he proposes biographic empathy and discusses the possible applications of this alternative system. All these talks refer to John's book, Quest for the Zodiac, recently reissued by the Marian Institute. But let's go now to John Lash so that he can speak to us about the first part of these talks.
Thank you, Joanna. There's a lot to say about astrology, or I perhaps should say I have a lot to say about astrology because it's been a major part of my life and my studies and my spiritual journey, if you will. And the title of these talks concerns astrology and what it's not. So the subject is even broader than you might imagine at first, because in the process of working with astrology, I discovered what astrology is not. And that is what I will try to tell you about in the course of these three talks. I think it would be appropriate if I started with a bit of an account of how I came into the field of astrology and how I got involved with it in the first place. I will try to keep the personal content fairly limited and just give you a quick kind of overview of how this happened for me. It was a long evolution, and I practiced as an astrologer for 30 years, and actually the evolution was even longer than that, because there was a time that led me into that practice before I actually hung out the shingle, and then there was also a time when I kind of tapered off the practice, but I still continued to be very involved with the question, and the question of destiny, which I'm going to talk about here, and the question of what is the option for another kind of astrology. I think as far as I can recall, the first time that I read anything about astrology was when I was sitting beside the lotus pool at the world headquarters of the Theosophical Society in Adyar, India, and that would have been in the fall of 1965. And at that time, I was reading some Gurdjieff and Uspensky. I was dabbling in Blavatsky and the whole theosophical scenario. And among the theosophists was a famous astrologer named Alan Leo, perhaps one of the most famous astrologers of the 19th and early 20th century. And there were five or six musty volumes of very impressive looking books by Alan Leo, which I dove into at that time. So I actually came in at the really at a strange end of astrology, at a strange angle, you could say, because Leo's astrology was very wrapped up with esotericism, occultism, and the whole Blavatsky view of the ancient wisdom tradition. So one thing that I had to do over the years, and it was, I must say, quite a strenuous effort, is I had to sort out the kind of astrology I wanted to practice, the kind of astrology that looked valid to me, because as I first encountered it, it came with an awful lot of esoteric baggage. Well, then I returned to the United States in 1966 after traveling around in Asia for a while, and I was living in the Lower East Side during the peak moment of the psychedelic revolution, just when the second generation took off, 65, 66. And there I bought my first book on astrology at Weiser's bookstore, which used to be located on 14th Street. And from there on, began to study and apply myself. I also read Max Heindel. Have to point out that there were extremely few books on astrology available at this time. I think there was an explosion of astrology from the mid to late 70s onward. And so some of you who are accustomed to going into a metaphysical bookstore, such as the Bodhi Tree in Los Angeles, and seeing wall after wall of astrology books, need to try to imagine that there was only a handful of astrology books available when I started my work. So it picked up very fast in the 70s, and I was part of that movement. I was involved in the movement when it became very popular, you know, when Linda Goodman's Sun Signs was a bestseller and everyone was chatting about it. And it is, by the way, still an excellent book, and you will find a great deal of personal insight in that book, Sun Signs by Linda Goodman. Anyway, to cut to the chase, I learned how to cast horoscopes, which we used to do by hand, using the Rosicrucian ephemerises and various things like that. I used to use slide rules. This was even in the day before calculators. And from the very beginning of my plunge into astrology, I encountered two very serious problems, which never really went away. The first problem was I did not believe in planetary influences. Well, most of the astrology written in the 19th and early 20th century used a language that spoke of planetary influences. You know, Mars on the ascendant makes you antagonistic, things of this sort. I was extremely put off by this language. And it became clear to me in my first or second year of studying astrology, before I ever dared to cast anyone else's horoscope, that I was going to have a lot of problem with the language. The syntax did not suit me in the least. So I rejected the idea of planetary influence. I'll get back to that in a second. The other point that gave me a lot of trouble was that astrology, many astrologers used astrology to predict, and I absolutely refused to do predictions. I didn't see any point in doing predictions. I found it fatalistic and stupid. Vedic astrology, which I had encountered in India, is extremely deterministic and fatalistic, and they predict things down to the minute. Now, many people are impressed by these predictions, how an astrologer can sit down and tell you something is going to happen to you, or it does, or how an astrologer can sit down and tell you when something happened to you in the past. I found that all, again, very off-putting. I wasn't on that trail. I was interested in finding in astrology an evolutionary language and a kind of universal code of some kind, even though I couldn't exactly say what that code was. So you can understand what my dilemma was and how hard it was for me in the beginning, because I didn't find that code was not by any means self-evident.
Yes, and you have worked a very long time in developing a new language. In fact, a new language for astrology. In fact, you had a curious happening in India where you went to see a Madame Sarasvati and she predicted something to you.
Yeah, that was remarkable. As I just said, the Vedic astrologers are masters of prediction. And the one time in my life I went to an astrologer was when I was 19 years old in Madras, India. I don't know how. It just happened by chance that I ran into someone who said, go see Madame Sarasvati. That's the name of the goddess of wisdom, a kind of Sophia figure, who lives over there in these tenement houses, and she'll read your fortune. So I went in to see her, and she did a funny thing. She asked me my birthday, and then she sat down and she got out her ephemerides, her books of planetary positions, which were obviously Vedic ephemerides. So they were using the Jyotish, or the Hindu version of astrology. And I remember seeing her. She's quite a tall, elegant woman, the color of kind of cinnamon or a nut color. This was in southern India. And I remember she sat there for a while, kind of counting on her fingers and looking at a book and then counting some more on her fingers and looking at me. And so finally she said to me two things. She said, you are going to have a long and hard spiritual journey in life, and you will not actually see the horizon of success until you are in your mid or late 50s. The second thing she said to me was that I had an extraordinary gift to bring into the world. Because it was so extraordinary, it was going to take a long time. And she said that I was going to bring forth a new language that would be a kind of blend of music and mathematics. And in this new language, I would be able to say things or describe or discover things about the human soul in ways that had not been previously expressed. And I must say thank you to Madame Sarasvati, because that is, in fact, exactly what I did. And that is what I'm in the process of telling you about right now. So I took up the study of astrology, and I was about 20, 21 years old, and then I eventually moved to Los Angeles. And when I was living in Los Angeles, and I started to practice and do charts. I think I was charging like $10 a piece at the beginning, and considerably more than that at the end. But I was really having a hard time, because it became clear to me that I couldn't just read the cookbooks on astrology and then turn around and regurgitate that material to my clients. I felt deeply obligated to give my clients some original insight, and also to help them build a vision of their lives that they could support and sustain independently of me. My object was never to be a guru or someone that the clients relied on to come back again and again for in a kind of dependency. Although I did have some reliable clients that I did each year, see each year. I did their transits, I did their solar returns and so forth. But on the whole, I just tried to diminish that role and to teach people to be what I came to call self-directing. So I invented this word, self-direction. I only talk to you about your chart in order to hone your capacities for self-direction. And the language in which I did this was at times extremely awkward. It was painful for me. I think at moments I gave some pretty good readings, and at other moments I gave some pretty lame, bad readings, because in fact I was improvising all the time. I mean, by the time we got to the mid-70s now, let's say I had been working for 7 or 8 years in astrology, then some interesting books began to appear by Francis Sequoyah and the Robert Hand books and all these, but they were all astrological cookbooks. That is to say, you would look in them, the moon in Cancer, moon in Leo, moon in Virgo, moon in Scorpio, and you get all these formulas, and then you put all these formulas together and read them back to your client. I absolutely refused to do that. I didn't find that those formulas were helpful, although I used them from time to time. And it was really, I must say, as I'm recalling it now, it was really painfully awkward and difficult for me to practice astrology. However, there were two breakthroughs that came in the early 70s, around 1973 and 1974. The first breakthrough was that I had a job on the coast of Northern California near Mendocino doing gardening in an expensive hotel. And one of the young people of my generation, whose name was also John, was working with me. So we had a lot of time to chat while we were weeding the gardens and pruning the flowers. And he introduced me to a book called The Astrology of Personality by Dane Rudyard, R-U-D-H-Y-A-R. And in fact, he gave me his copy of The Astrology of Personality and signed it to me, which I still have. This book really broke open the field of astrology for me for a number of reasons. Rudyard was a great intellectual, musician, a philosopher, a mystic, and I think by any standard, the greatest astrologer of the 20th century. He wrote The Astrology of Personality, strangely enough, in Taos, New Mexico, around the time that I was born, 1945, 46, 47. And what I got from Dane Rudyard was a powerful impact based on one insight. Rudyard said that astrology is just a symbolic language for reading the patterns of behavior of human beings and reading into the deep patterns of the human psyche. And so, in fact, Rudyard did not follow a causal approach to astrology at all. So here suddenly I had the approval of a genius of astrology saying, no, it's not causal. We don't have to talk about planetary influences. We don't have to predict. We just have to use this symbolic language to delve into the workings of the human psyche and to profile personality, examine complexes, and in that way mirror to people a clearer understanding of their own behavior. And that was extremely liberating for me. Also, Rudyard was a great synthesist, and his book, The Astrology of Personality, talks about Jungian archetypes, the I Ching, the Sephiroth, the Tree of Life, and he showed that astrology was a universal code that can be transposed and translated into these other codes. So I felt suddenly that I had been given the lead I needed to proceed with my own original sense of what astrology might be. And after I read Dane Rudyard and I read all of his books, of which are about eight, I had much more confidence in my readings with people and much more of a sense that I was getting the language right.
You came to design your own system of astrology, and I would like to hear how you evolved this. First within yourself, and then later in writing, which has been published in the book Quest for the Zodiac, The Cosmic Code Beyond Astrology. In fact, when I met you 21 years ago, I'm probably anticipating, but when I met you 20 years ago, you gave me the most seductive tool any man has ever given a woman. You used to come to my house and you used to pin on the front door constellations that you had designed yourself. I was extraordinarily intrigued because here was this man who was connecting the dots in the sky in a new way. This hadn't been done since Dürer. What century was Dürer? 1520. The connecting of the dots in the sky had never been questioned by anyone since then. And I was aware of that, and I thought it was extraordinary and extremely romantic that someone would have the poetry to connect the dots in a different way, finally.
Yes, I remember when I went to your house on Militar, I had a Valentine for you the first time I came to your house, and that was the constellation of Gemini, or the twins, which I had redesigned as the constellation of the lovers. So it represented two figures who were dancing a kind of tango together. And that was a good, I think that was a lovely inspiration for us at that time. This is anticipates a little bit, Joanna, but it is right on the track, because after I had the breakthrough with Rudyar and I was able to practice astrology, which was my main way of making a living at the time, I also had the freedom, with a little success and confidence in the game, I had the freedom to start experimenting more. And my experimentations began with two technical breakthroughs, two technical innovations of mine, which, as far as I know, remain unique to this day. And these were developed in Los Angeles around 1976. The first innovation, and I'm not going to be too technical about this because I know the technicalities of astrology can be a bit daunting for non-astrologers, but there is a tool that all astrologers use called the house system, the system of houses. There are 12 houses, and this is simply a way of dividing up the visible heavens around the birthplace so that you can place each of the planets in a certain sector. So we might say when someone is born, they had Saturn in the sixth house, or they had the sun in the 10th house, which would mean they were born around noon. Well, these house systems, I studied them in 1975, 6, and 7 in Los Angeles, and there were about 8 of them. And what I discovered is that these formats, these formatting tools, geometrical tools for dividing up the sky, were all invented by medieval monks back in the Middle Ages, and they reflected an understanding of space and the structure of space-time that to me was completely passé. And even the more recent house systems, such as the Koch, K-O-C-H, house system, the newer ones, suffered from the same fault. Well, I had been studying Einsteinian theory and non-Euclidean geometry since I was 16 years old. And I was interested in a more sophisticated model of space and time, what I called a mandala of space and time. I thought that the house system that would be used to locate the planets and then to interpret their values should be accurate, physically accurate. I wasn't going to sacrifice any of that accuracy, but that it should reflect a much more sophisticated concept of spatio-temporal relations. And actually, through the work of Goethe and Goethe's concept of morphology, and through some other studies that I found among the anthroposophical people that I knew at that time, I came up with a new format, which I called the pteroscope instead of the horoscope. And the pteroscope completely changed my way of working with astrology and gave me a new format that I felt was compatible with the new language that I was looking for, that I was seeking to work out. So some of you may understand what I'm talking about here by creating a new house system. In any case, the point is that I had a tool that I liked very much. It was sophisticated, and it worked beautifully in practice. The second thing was the breakthrough that came from discovering the star zodiac. This breakthrough was always, in a way, in the back of my mind, but I didn't know how to move in the direction of the star zodiac at the beginning. I was fortunate enough to grow up in the country on the coast of Maine, and whenever the sky was clear, I could see the stars very well. And when I traveled in Asia and sailed across the Indian Ocean or hung out in the Himalayas, I could see the whole stars, the whole panorama of stars in the sky. And I was immensely fascinated by these star patterns. As soon as I began to read astrology books, I realized that the signs used by astrologers did not represent these star patterns, and I was extremely baffled by that. So, again, I was working in a medium that didn't satisfy me, and I was driven to find a new way to change that medium and make myself comfortable with it. I was just looking at the map of Los Angeles on Google Maps to see where North Cahuenga was, because when I think that's where the local library, the Hollywood Library, was located when I was living in Hollywood. So I used to walk down from the Hollywood Hills and go to North Cahuenga and go into the library and pour through the astronomy books, not the astrology books. One of the things that really disturbed and yet excited me at that time was the realization that most astrologers don't know anything about astronomy, and they don't study astronomy, and they don't study the details of the astronomical mapping of the world. How can this be? Well, as I point out in my book, Quest for the Zodiac, the term astrology is very misleading, because literally it means the science of the stars. But as a matter of fact, the most popular format of astrology, which is called the tropical zodiac, which is used by almost all astrologers in the world today, has nothing to do with the stars and totally ignores the stars. Now, I'll explain that more in detail in the second talk. I just want to point out, as we get more or less to the halfway point in this talk, that I recognized that there were two zodiacs after I had been working with astrology for about 8 years. And I recognized that there was almost no information on the second zodiac, which is to say the zodiac that you can actually see in the sky, the patterns of the constellations, which are said to represent various animals, such as a lion, a crab, and also other objects, such as a pair of scales, and other fantastic creatures, such as a goatfish or a centaur. These are the ancient images in the sky, but sun sign astrology, as it's called, does not recognize these images. And so, in a sense, astrology misleads people. It may provide them with correct information, but it misleads people as to where that information is coming from. Now, I'm not going to spend any time in these three talks bashing or putting down the so-called tropical astrologers. I myself was a tropical astrologer for 30 years. I used the starless model of the signs. And I can tell you that it works. I can tell you that if you sit down with a competent astrologer who looks at the sun in Gemini, the moon in Cancer, and Venus conjunct Saturn in Taurus, and these various things, and looks at the house positions of these planets, that astrologer will be able to profile your personality in an absolutely amazing manner. I have had many experiences in which I would sit down with someone who was to me really a total stranger. All I had was their birth data. I had constructed their astrology chart, and yet within a matter of half an hour I would be able to discuss with them in detail the driving complexes of their lives, the things that have concerned them the most, and the things that they were seeking to do with their lives. So I want to make it clear in this first talk that I would never invalidate tropical astrology as such. But at the same time that I was using tropical astrology for personality profiling, I was reaching toward this other format, which I call stellar or constellational astrology. And after a certain time, and this happened also before I left LA, so it must have been by the end of the 70s, I was already using both formats. I redesigned the horoscope in a number of ways. One thing I did was I changed the house system to the Terrascope. The second thing I did was I added a rim around the horoscope that showed the pictures of the actual constellations. And the third thing I did was that I changed the glyphs or symbols for all the signs and planets to symbols that I thought were more appropriate. Well, that was a huge work of overhaul. And actually, my practice as an astrologer during the 70s and 80s consisted maybe in one-third of the time giving consultations, but two-thirds of the time working on this new system. And it was a massive job. As I explain in one of the chapters of Quest for the Zodiac, there were many, many times when I was totally overwhelmed by this situation and completely would either become confused or depressed for days or weeks on end because I just couldn't find my way into this code. I understood that the star zodiac represented a code, and yet there was no one, no book that I could find, or no expert or astrologer, except Dane Rudjar, who alluded to the star zodiac, who could give me any clue to what the code was about. So I really had to hack it out on my own, and it was a long, long haul. One of the things that helped me enormously to work out the code of the star zodiac was my studies in mythology. And when I went back to ancient times and looked at certain mythological figures, such as the twins Romulus and Remus, who were supposed to have founded the Roman Empire, I found that all of these figures were linked in some way to the actual star patterns. So one thing that I knew, long before I could decode those star patterns as I can now, was that mythology was a way of reading them. Mythology gave me a tool for understanding what those constellations, the information that those constellations contained. So from that point on, I would say from the early 80s on until through the 80s and well into the mid-90s when I stopped basically doing astrology, for the last 15 years of my life, I concentrated on developing the star zodiac, and this whole progression is explained in my book, Quest for the Zodiac. So linked to these talks on Future Primitive, there are going to be a couple of places you can click that will take you into metahistory.org and explain a little bit about what I'm talking about here. For instance, show you what an actual constellation looks like and compare it to what a sign is so that you'll be able to see the difference and understand what I'm talking about. And that's going to be, that difference is going to be the subject of my next talk in this series.
If your language of astrology is the language of the stars, why do you call it terrastrology?
Yeah, Joanna's picking up on a word here that I coined. Terrastrology. I haven't used this word for many, many years. But during the period I just described, I had to put a different label on what I was doing. I had to put a label on it that reflected that it was a new format. So I called it terrastrology. That's choice reveals another one of my innovations. I made very, very many innovations, and I'm only skimming over what they were here in this talk. But one of the innovations that I made early on was that I included the Earth in the planets in the horoscope. I thought it entirely absurd when I began to study astrology that we would talk about the influence of Mars, the influence of Venus, the influence of the Sun, and no one was talking about the influence of the Earth. And I thought, well, it has to be important that we understand the influence of the Earth for two obvious reasons. If we're going to speak of influence in a metaphorical sense, the first reason is that the Earth is obviously the planet that influences us more than any other. So how can it be left out of the astrological pattern? It is our habitat. It is the place where we're born and where we die. It is the most powerful planet and the one we are closest to. So how can we possibly overlook it? I thought it was absolutely ludicrous. The second point is, there's a possibility that we, the human species, might have an influence on the cosmos. Now, I got this idea from Paracelsus. I read a lot of alchemy and studied and taught alchemy during the same years that I was doing this innovative work in astrology. And in fact, the course that I gave, which is just called The Course, which is kind of a reformulation of ancient alchemy, contained a great deal of astrology. I used to give astrology classes in Santa Fe. And reading Paracelsus really impacted me, especially his book called Astronomia Magia, in which he introduced the idea that we need to consider the influence of the Earth upon the cosmos, and that we need to consider that humanity inhabiting the Earth has some returning influence to the cosmos at large. We are not just animals who are driven hither and thither by the patterns of planetary motion or by powerful transits and squares of one planet to another and so forth. I completely rejected that notion of causative astrology. And I tried to, I would tell people, you know, in Santa Fe, there were obviously many people who'd had their horoscope done by other astrologers, and I had a fair amount of competition over the years. But people would come to me because they knew they would hear things they wouldn't hear elsewhere. And one of the things they would hear is where the Earth was located when they were born and what was the significance of the Earth in their horoscope. That's why I called it terrastrology, putting on the word Earth on there. So this was obviously a long and complicated process. And I'm happy to say that in 1999, I was able to pull together what I've learned so far and put it in my book, Quest for the Zodiac, which presents a new, totally new perspective on astrology. And I think that I want to point out that Quest for the Zodiac is not just a summation of my work and my research, but it's also a challenge because I have not completed this work and cannot. I cannot complete it, and I will not be able to complete it. It's a project that needs to be completed by other people as well. And so I invite collaborators in this project. What I have done in Quest for the Zodiac is set out the framework for the astrology of the future, which is based on the real sky zodiac, and which, as I will explain in the two coming talks, allows us to read into the phylogenetic record of our species. This is a discovery that I consider to be totally astounding, and I hope that the fact that I'm the one who made the discovery doesn't discount that impression. So you have something to look forward to, I think, if you hang on to these talks, because I will be I wrote Quest for the Zodiac, but I haven't actually taught this alternative form of astrology or lectured about it anywhere so far. Because of the circumstances of my life, I got into the Gnostic work, I had other things to do, and so this is the first time that I'm actually coming out and speaking publicly about what I accomplished and inviting you to be, you know, to take an interest in this fantastic this fantastic breakthrough, really, in our understanding of destiny and evolution.
I think we leave it here for now, and I want to thank you, John, and I want to thank you, friends, for listening, and look out, because we will be doing these three talks in the next week. So, hope you catch all of that, and again, in gratitude.